Yet even while he was busily occupied in that virtuous endeavour, certain parties here in Rome made evil use of his absence, and ventured on many odious schemes, so that we came desperately to long for his return. And so, abandoning fresh victories within his grasp, otherwise all of Britannia would be ours today, Caesar rushed to our assistance, and quickly freed all Italy from the dangers that threatened. When he saw that Pompey, who had abandoned his country and was setting up a kingdom of his own, transferring all the wealth of Rome to Greece and Asia, using your own money against you, Caesar at first did his best to persuade Pompey to desist and to change course, sending mediators to him privately and publicly, and offering solemn pledges of peace. When Pompey refused all entreaties and cut all ties with Rome, even the bond of friendship that existed between himself and Caesar, and chose to fight against you, then, and only then at last, was Caesar compelled to begin the civil war. But what need is there to remind you how daringly he sailed against Pompey in spite of the winter, or how boldly he assailed him, though Pompey held all the strong positions, or how bravely he vanquished him, though Pompey's troops, gathered from all Asia and Greece, were vastly greater in number. I was there that day in Pharsalia, fighting beside Caesar. With my own eyes I saw how great was Caesar's military genius. The Great One, Pompey, called himself. But Pompey was shown to be a mere child, so completely was the great general out-generaled at every point. I thought this dig at Pompey might draw some ire from the crowd, for the people surrounding me appeared to be partisans of Caesar through and through. If there were supporters of Pompey or Cato among us, they made not a peep of protest. He spoke of Caesar's virtues, which went far beyond his military genius, the keen intellect that allowed him to master every situation, the shrewd insight into other men's characters that made him such a natural leader, the piety that made him so eminently suited for the office of Pontifex Maximus, the generosity of which the citizens of Rome on this day were but the latest recipients, and above all, Caesar's tendency to be merciful and to forgive. What other man, having achieved by military might the defeat of all his enemies, ever showed such clemency toward the defeated? Yet Caesar always showed mercy to those who opposed him. Even to Pompey he would have issued a pardon had not the Egyptians killed him first. Think of the mercy he showed to so many men who joined with Pompey's cause, and then, bested by Caesar, had every reason to think that Caesar would put them to death. But did he? No. Quite the opposite. He welcomed those men back to Rome with open arms. He gave them back their houses and their estates. He allowed them to return to the Senate. He even appointed them to high office. In return, they took a solemn vow to keep him safe from all harm. If some were ungrateful, if some broke that vow, Caesar wasn't to blame, though you see before you the price he paid for their ingratitude. "Miserable wretches," cried someone, and another, "he should have chopped off their heads while he had the chance." Antony waved for silence. Has any man in all of history ever been so great, not just in power, but in spirit? Think of this remarkable fact. that in the case of virtually every man who ever achieved so much power, that power only served to reveal and foster his weaknesses. The more powerful such men became, the more selfish and petty and decadent. Yet in Caesar's case, the exact opposite was true. Every increase in his authority only served to increase his virtues. The more powerful he became, the more virtuous he grew, until, at the end, can anyone deny that he was by far the best among us? Warfare did not brutalize him. Good fortune did not corrupt him. Power did not pollute him. Those things only made him greater of spirit, wiser, more merciful, more just. What an extraordinary man! More than a man! Who can doubt his divinity? And yet, this father of the fatherland, this Pontifex Maximus, this inviolable being, this hero, this god, is dead. Dead. Not taken from us by disease, or wasted by old age, or brought low by witchcraft. Nor was he wounded in warfare, fighting on your behalf in some distant land. No. He died right here, within the walls of this city, the place in all the world where he should have been safest. He is dead by violence, because of a plot against him. He was ambushed in the city he loved, murdered in the chambers of the Senate. The man who was building for us a far more splendid new Senate house at his own expense. The bravest warrior died unarmed. The most beloved bringer of peace died defenseless. The wisest of all judges died because lesser men decided his fate. No enemy of Rome was ever able to bring him down, though his exploits gave them many a chance. Once I asked him what had been the closest of his many close scrapes with death. It was in Alexandria, he said, when in the midst of battle his ship sank in the harbour. Enemy ships converged on him, spears and arrows and catapulted stones fell all around him. Dead men littered the water. The churning waves were red with blood as his crimson cape, which he refused to abandon, though the weight of it dragged at him with every stroke and threatened to drown him. When at last he reached the shore, by some miracle still alive, any other man would have been shaken and exhausted, weeping with relief. What did Caesar do? Without missing a breath, he resumed his command and carried the day for Rome. It wasn't the fate of Caesar to die in battle that day, nor ever to die in battle. As I say, no foreign enemy killed him, though many tried. He was killed by fellow citizens, by Romans, by comrades, slain not by foes, but by friends. Antony's words had so stirred the crowd that the sound of men shouting had become continuous, like the weeping that never stopped. It was a testament to his oratorical powers, that I was still able to hear every word he said, even above the growing roar of the mob. Here he lies now. Here, in the forum through which so many times he paraded in glorious triumph. Here lies his mute body on the platform from which so many times he spoke to you. Does it seem impossible that great Caesar is dead? I assure you he is, for I have seen with my own eyes the blank, lifeless eyes of his corpse. I have seen and counted the many cuts that scar his body. So many, so horrible to look at. Show us, people cried. Show us the body. I cannot, said Antony. The wishes of the widow must be respected. She doesn't want your last image of Caesar to be the mangled remains fit now only for the flames. Nor would Caesar want that. Look instead at the masks on those men who represent his triumphs. Remember his serene countenance in life. Imagine that he still lives and looks kindly upon you. The shouting grew louder. No! Show us the body! Show us what the killers did to him! Antony seemed to hesitate, torn by indecision. Again, I thought that he might step up to the golden shrine, yank away the cloth, lay hands on Caesar's torn and crumpled body, and hold it up for all to see. I held my breath, imagining the effect on the furious crowd. Instead, Antony did something even more provocative. He laid aside the will, which he had been clutching all this time, using it to jab the air for emphasis. With both hands, he took hold of the pole on which Caesar's effigy was mounted. He raised the effigy high in the air and strode from one end of the rostra to the other, back and forth, turning the effigy to show all sides of it. "I cannot show you the body," Antony shouted, "but I can show you the toga he wore on the last day of his life. Every place the fabric is torn and stained with blood marks, the cut of the dagger that ripped his flesh. So many daggers, so much blood." The effect on the crowd was like a thunderbolt from heaven. The sound of weeping, wailing, moaning, screaming, shouting, and the banging of swords on shields was deafening. Never had I heard such a din. Antony continued to stride back and forth across the platform, holding up the effigy. His mouth moved, but I could no longer hear him. For one uncanny instant, the face of the effigy was turned in such a way that it seemed to look straight at me. The illusion of seeing Caesar again, reduced to nothing more than a head and torso, draped in bloody purple and gold, was so bizarre and so powerful that I felt disconnected from the moment, detached even from myself. Cinna shouted in my ear, "This is even worse than I imagined. Much worse. We must get out of here at once." "Easier said than done," I muttered, coming to my senses and looking all around. The crowd had become a shouting, surging mob. I saw the flicker of flames from the corner of my eye and looked at the speaker's platform. Men with torches had joined Antony on the rostra. "Burn him here," I heard people shout. "Right here in the forum. Burn him as Claudius was burned." Someone nearby shouted, "Burn down the houses of every assassin. Burn the killers. Set them on fire. Watch them burn." His eyes wide with alarm, Davis clutched my arm to keep me from being swept away. Cinna clutched my other arm and hissed in my ear, "These fools will burn down the city." I looked again at the rostra. Antony and the effigy on a pole had vanished. More men with torches appeared. Others set about removing the body of Caesar from the golden shrine. Was this what Antony intended? Fulvia had seen Clodius cremated in the midst of the forum. Was Caesar to be burned there as well? "There!" cried Davis. "I think I see a way out." He turned to Cinna's bodyguard. The two of us, together, can clear a path. The man nodded. The two of them stepped into a rift that had opened in the mob and elbowed their way forward. Like boys following their elders, Cinna and I clutched at their garments and did our best to keep up. A tremor of fear swept over me. Death seemed very close. Chapter 44. At every turn, voices screamed in my ears. Elbows and knees assaulted me. Faces, made hideous by hatred and grief, flashed by me, each more contorted and unnerving than the last, like an endless procession of hideous tragedy masks. These were interspersed with shadowy faces I couldn't see, more of those hooded figures that had alarmed me early on. At some point I was struck by something larger and more unyielding than an elbow. I realized it was a piece of wooden furniture, a chair. Then another piece of furniture went by, a bookcase on its side with a single forlorn-looking scroll still clinging to its pigeonhole. I barely managed to dodge the massive piece. Had I been knocked down, I would surely have been trampled. "What in Hades?" shouted Cinna. "Fuel for the fire," I shouted back. "It was the same when they burned Clodius. The mob looted every building nearby for anything that would burn." The men carrying furniture seemed to be heading in one direction while we were heading in another. That seemed good. But when I looked around for a familiar landmark, I realized we were no nearer the outskirts of the forum than we had been when we started. The mob seemed to have carried us in a circle. We were like leaves in a vortex. "Where is Davis?" I shouted, realizing I had lost hold of his tunic. I couldn't see him ahead of us. "And your man, Cinna, where are they?"
"I don't know. I can't see either of them."
His shout was close to a wail, verging on panic. I smelled a wood fire, then heard a great roar that had to be the excited cry of the mob as the first flames leaped up. A makeshift funeral pyre had been built somewhere, perhaps quite nearby. Our goal now must be to head in any direction away from it. But where was it? I could see no flames, only smell the smoke. There were other scents as well. The flowers and aromatic herbs that had been part of Caesar's beer now set aflame and smoking. How long would it be until we smelled his burning flesh? More chairs and bookcases went by, as well as tables, cabinets, and curtains. Cinna and I both managed to dodge these moving obstacles, but not everyone was so lucky. More than once I stepped on flesh and heard a scream of pain, but there was no way to stop and help whatever poor mortal had fallen. The surge of the crowd was too strong. "This way," I shouted to Cinna, grabbing his arm. I had spotted the round roof of the Temple of Vesta, as good a place to flee to as any other. We doggedly strove toward it, and began to make progress as the crush of the crowd relented slightly. For the first time since the riot had started, I felt able to breathe again. The air I desperately sucked in carried less smoke than before, though now I caught a whiff of something else, quite aromatic, the unmistakable scent produced by burning myrrh. We had almost reached the Temple of Vesta. The crowd grew thinner. Every person we encountered was running in the opposite direction, toward the surging mob and the pyre. It seemed that only we two were attempting to flee. I stopped to look behind us, hoping that Davis and Cinna's bodyguard had somehow managed to follow us, but I didn't see them. How dearly I longed to see my hulking son-in-law at that moment. From nearby, from what direction I couldn't tell, for the surrounding walls of marble created strange echoes, a gruff, husky voice cried,
Sinner! It's him! Look! There he is! There's Sinner!
Sinner also heard and glanced around. On his face was the insipid look of pleasure one sees so often on the faces of politicians and actors when they are recognized in public. He smiled as he continued to search for the speaker.
"Can it be, even here amid such frenzy, a poetry lover?" he said, and then, more loudly, raising one hand in a friendly wave, "Yes, it is I, Sinner."
I turned around again, and now saw a hooded group approaching from the direction we had come. There were at least 20 of them, perhaps twice that many, perhaps even more. Their dark cloaks and hoods made them blend together in a single, faceless mass. Sinner, too, saw the group approaching, and gave them a broad smile. I reached for his waving arm, thinking to hold him back, but he stepped away from me. Sensing danger, I reached for him again, and the next moment I was somehow on the hard, paved ground and the world was spinning around me. My head was struck a second time. The world grew dim. I didn't lose consciousness entirely, so I later came to think. It seemed to me that I continued to see and hear what was happening around me, but imperfectly and in flashes, as if the world was suddenly a dark place lit only by lightning, while a continuous peal of thunder muffled all other sounds. I could make no sense of what was happening. Time and space were all askew. I was stunned, frightened, and very confused. Looking up from the ground, I saw Sinner nearby, then didn't see him as he was surrounded by the figures in dark cloaks and hoods. My view of those figures was foreshortened, creating the strange illusion that it was children whom I saw all around us. The hooded figures seemed weirdly small. Could they really all be poetry lovers, mobbing Sinner as one sometimes sees theatre-goers mob a famous actor? Then I heard the same husky voice I had heard before, shouting,
"It's him, all right! It's Sinner! The praetor who spoke ill of Caesar the other day and praised his killers. Tear him to pieces!"
Though I could no longer see him, I heard Sinner wailing, as if from some great distance, or as if he had fallen down a well.
"No, no, no! You have the wrong man! I'm Sinner the poet, not Sinner the praetor. I make verses."
Some old crone must have been among the rioters, for I heard a cackling voice cry out,
"Dare him for his bad verses, then!"
"No," I wanted to cry, "you have the wrong man. This is a horrible mistake. It's the other Sinner you're thinking of."
But as the dark world continued to swirl unsteadily about me, I found it impossible to speak. Then, for a moment or two, perhaps I did lose consciousness entirely. For the next thing I saw was something from a nightmare. The severed head of Sinner, held aloft by a claw-like hand, dripping blood and gore from the torn neck. On my friend's face was a look of utter shock. His mouth gaped and his eyes were wide open, showing white all around the huge pupils. Then I saw something even more horrible. The lips of his mouth moved, as if trying to speak, and his eyes blinked, not once, but several times in quick succession. What did Sinner see? What was he trying to say? I heard screams, not from Sinner's killers, but from other people who had stumbled on the scene and turned to flee in terror.
"No, don't leave us," I tried to cry out. "Come back, come back, help us, please."
But my numb, useless mouth made no more noise than the moving lips of Sinner. Amid the swarms of dark cloaks, I saw blood fly through the air, ribbons of blood, jets of blood in all directions. It seemed to me that the sky had burst open and was raining blood. The head of Sinner still held aloft, was now joined by what appeared to be a severed hand, clutched by a gnarled, hardly human claw covered with blood. Then other parts of Cinna's body appeared, raised high in the air like trophies. Another severed hand, something that looked like a forearm, a foot, a stump of flesh that might have been part of his leg, all awash with blood and gore, as were the hands that clutched them. When I saw his severed genitals held aloft, my mind reeled in disbelief. The horror of what I was seeing, the sheer savagery, could not be real. This had to be some hideous fantasy from my darkest nightmare, or some terrible vision conjured up by witchcraft. Or was I dying? Or already dead? Was this the world of the unliving, a place of horrors beyond imagining? Now the swarming assailants abruptly seemed to grow even smaller. But this was another illusion. It wasn't they who dwindled, but the head of Cinna that suddenly rose higher in the air, mounted above them on a spear. Up and down it bobbed, and from side to side, like some ghastly puppet looming above me. I thought of Caesar's effigy, held aloft for the crowd by Antony, but this was no semblance of the dead. It was a dead man himself. Looking up at his face, I shivered in disbelief. Could what I saw be true, that Cinna's lips still moved, and his eyes still blinked? I heard more screams, but not all were cries of terror. Some people seemed to be screaming in a frenzy of delight. I also heard laughter and applause, as if the scene I witnessed came from some hilarious comedy. "Cinna the Praetor!" someone shouted. "They came upon Cinna the Praetor, and look what they've done! Ripped off his head and torn the bastard to pieces!" "No more than he deserves!" shouted another man. Out of this cacophony of taunts and shouts, I gradually perceived a chant taken up by the mob. "I'm glad he's dead," Cinna said. "Now look what's left, just his head." Over and over they chanted this doggerel, as the head on a spear spun about and bobbed in time, facing one way and the other, then sped off in the direction we had come, back toward the funeral pyre. From the distant mob I heard rolling peals of laughter and screams as the head made its way toward the center of the forum. Louder and louder, echoing off marble walls, I heard the chant. "I'm glad he's dead," Cinna said. "Now look what's left, just his head." Thousands were chanting it. I pictured the funeral pyre with Caesar's blazing corpse amid the surging mass of angry mourners, and amid the throng, the bobbing head of Cinna, and the effigy of Caesar, like two puppets, meant to amuse children at some mad festival of death. How Cinna would have despised that vulgar ditty! How unthinkable that such vile doggerel should celebrate the death of Rome's greatest poet! I somehow managed to get to my hands and knees. Nearby I saw the crumpled, tattered remains of the dark tunic Cinna had been wearing. It was completely soaked with blood, and blood was everywhere on the paving stones. His head, I knew, was gone. But where was the rest of him? There was nothing of his corpse to be seen, except for the tunic and the blood, and a few bits of slime and gore. No trace of him remained. Father-in-law! Even amid so much horror, I felt a flood of relief, as did my son-in-law, to judge from the tears that flowed down his cheeks as he ran toward me. Father-in-law, thank the gods I found you. But are you wounded? All this blood? No, not wounded, I said, feeling myself to make sure. Thank the gods you're here, Davis. Cinna's bodyguard, is he with you? No, lost in the crowd. But where is Sinner? What's become of him? I looked around at the pools of blood. Helped by Davis, I staggered to my feet.
"I don't know," I whispered. "I don't know."
Day 12, March 21st. Chapter 45. "This bump on your head is the size of a lemon," declared Bethesda, dabbing it none too gently with a wet cloth. I winced. "And this other bump is twice that big." After a restless night filled with terrible dreams, I sat in the garden and submitted to my wife's doctoring. The morning air was still, and the sunlight quite warm. It would have been a beautiful day, were it not for the pall hanging over us. "You exaggerate, wife. They're no larger than a small olive, or an almond, perhaps. I've had worse bumps on my head." "Struck in the head by God knows what. Not once, but twice. You are very lucky to be alive," she said. "I'm not a gibbering idiot," my daughter added. "That can happen sometimes, from a blow to the head."
"I would say that you two are the lucky ones," I said. "Imagine having to bury me with the city in such a foul temper, or having to feed me porridge like a baby and wipe the drool from my chin."
Sitting nearby, Davis laughed. This drew sharp looks from both women.
"It's not funny," Diana said gravely. "You might both be dead, or horribly maimed. Where would Mother and I be then, two defenceless women in a city gone mad?"
"Something told me that my resourceful wife and daughter would manage without us, somehow." But Davis's smile faded, and he hung his head.
"I should never have lost sight of you. I still don't know how it happened. You were there behind me one moment. Then something seemed to come at me from the side, and I almost fell, and the mob spun me around. And by the time I righted myself, the three of you were gone, and I was alone. I should never have let that happen."
"The amazing thing is that you managed to find me again," I said. "You have the perseverance of a hunting dog." "And are almost as smart," I refrained from adding. "Diana, your husband pulled me to my feet, and then practically carried me all the way home. He deserves only praise. I take all the blame for putting us both in danger. I should have known better. I did know better. I went only because... because Sinner asked me to." I shuddered. "I suppose..." "Yes, husband?"
"I suppose I should go to his house today."
"To whose house?"
"The house of Sinner."
"I suppose you'll go nowhere at all," she protested. "Who's to say the streets are any safer today than yesterday? Mobs wearing hoods and carrying daggers, and all those men with torches set on arson? No, 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 you'll stay in."
I shook my head. "As soon as you've finished washing my wounds and I've had a bite to eat, I shall put on my toga. Sinner's toga, I should say. Senator Gordianus must pay a call on the grieving household of his dead friend."
"You can wait for his funeral."
"I think not.
Sinner had no close relations, no siblings or even close cousins, so he told me. But he had a daughter. I met her. A visit from me is the least she deserves. I was with her father in his final moments. I was there when he died. I saw. What exactly had I seen? A swarm of hooded pygmies bring down a giant of poetry and carry off his head for a trophy. Have they carried off the rest as well, leaving no vestige of his corpse behind? So jumbled and confused were my memories
I might have convinced myself that I had imagined it all, except that Davis, when I questioned him on the way home, revealed that he, too, had seen the head paraded on the spear, though he hadn't seen its face. He also heard the ditty chanted by the mob, though the words had seemed mere nonsense to him. What I had witnessed in dim flashes, reeling from the blows to my head, had actually taken place. Cinna had been beheaded and torn limb from limb. It happened so quickly. Bethesda shook her head. "Do you think it will comfort the poor girl to know that her father was beheaded? Perhaps she doesn't even know that he's dead. Perhaps she thinks he's only gone missing. All the more reason I must call on her. If she doesn't know what happened, she'll be sick with worry, and she shouldn't learn the details from some gossiping slave, though I dread seeing the shock on her face if I'm the first to tell her."
"Papa's right," Diana said quietly. "Cinna was his friend. He should do what he can to comfort Cinna's daughter. Perhaps we should go as well."
"Have you met the girl?" I asked. "At some gathering at Fulvia's, perhaps?"
"No,"
said Diana. Then she cocked her head.
"Actually, we did see her once, didn't we, Mother? She was leaving Fulvia's house just as we were arriving. Fulvia seemed to know her quite well. But when the girl saw us, she became very quiet and left very quickly, before Fulvia could introduce us. Such a shy thing, I thought. I asked Fulvia if the girl was a relative, and she said no. She told me the girl's name, which I remember only because it was so quaint. Imagine being called Sappho, and having Rome's most famous poet for a father."
I shook my head. "If you've never met the girl, then I think you should stay at home. First, let me determine the situation at Cinna's house." There was a black wreath on the door. I felt a flood of relief when I saw it. The wreath meant that his death was known already. I felt an overwhelming sense of absurdity. First I had seen Caesar die, then Cinna. One death was comprehensible, the other incomprehensible. The murder of Caesar had resulted from a cold-blooded decision made by men for motives all too understandable. Jealousy of his success, anger at his rule, fear of his wrath, desire for self-advancement, perhaps even ambition to take his place. The murder of Caesar did nothing to make me think the universe was meaningless. Quite the opposite. The death of Caesar was replete with meaning. But the killing of Cinna, a man of unique and surpassing talent, by mistake, for no reason whatsoever, was profoundly dispiriting. The death of Cinna epitomized a capricious, meaningless cosmos. Davis cleared his throat. "Father-in-law, how long had I been standing on the doorstep staring at the black wreath?" I knocked, then announced myself to an eye that peered from the peephole. My temples began to throb, and I reached up to touch the bandages Bethesda had wrapped around my head. An unseen slave opened the door. I wasn't entirely surprised to see Fulvia standing in the vestibule to greet me, suitably dressed in black. She and Antony had been friends of Cinna. With no mother to oversee the grieving of the household, Fulvia had taken responsibility. How busy she was, first with Caesar's funeral, and now with Cinna's. "Gordianus," Fulvia said, taking my hand, "it's good of you to come." "I thought perhaps I should say something to Sappho. Is that smell... do I smell myrrh?" I suddenly had a powerful sense memory of the myrrh I had smelled the previous day, only moments before Cinna was killed. The smell of it now made me feel nauseated. I broke out in a cold sweat. "Yes, I thought it proper to send to the house, though there's no actual need for it. No need to cloak any scent from the body, because there is no body. No body. I suddenly realized that if any part of Sinner remained, it would be the head carried on a spear through the forum. In such cases, when a corpse was intentionally defiled by a mob, it was traditional to throw the remains in the Tiber. Was that what had become of Sinner's head? Or was it still mounted on a spear in the forum? Surely not. Or was it here in the house, somehow retrieved by his friends or household slaves, the only thing left to display of the man's remains? Was it in the next room, placed on a bier for visitors to see? The thought was too grotesque to speak aloud, but Fulvia read my thoughts. No body, and no head. There's nothing of Sinner left. No remains to be cremated or buried. What became of him? I asked. You were there, were you not? So I was told. As usual, her intelligence was far-reaching and correct. Yes. And what exactly did you witness? Fulvia looked at me keenly. I was struck on the head, twice, thus the bandages. She nodded. So I presume. Yet you're well enough to leave your house? Yes. But what I saw yesterday is a bit of a blur, and so ghastly I had rather forget. But I did see his head being carried off. Was it not found later? The head has vanished, along with the rest of him, said Fulvia. Probably thrown into the Tiber. I nodded. How much does Sappho know? She knows that her father died by violence, that he was beheaded, that there's nothing left of him to show. And the reason it happened? Because the mob mistook him for the other Sinner. Yes. As you can imagine, she's quite distraught. I nodded. So you've come to help? That's good of you, Fulvia. My responsibility is a bit greater than that. I suppose you don't know, why should you, that Sappho was Sinner's only heir, and that Antony is named as Sappho's guardian in her father's will. When Sinner asked, not long ago, if we would accept the responsibility, Antony and I, of course, agreed. Never realizing who could have foreseen what happened to Sinner. Only the gods, I said. If indeed the gods see anything that happens on earth, or care. You mustn't speak impiously, Gordianus, especially in a grieving household. Here, step through, since you've come to pay your respects. She led Davis and me to the next room, where a funeral bier had been set up, complete with flowers and aromatic herbs. On the bier, where the corpse should have been, was the bloody tunic Sinner had been wearing when he died, flattened and laid out to suggest the form of the missing body. I drew a sharp breath. Surely his toga would be better, if there must be a garment to represent him. But this is what he was wearing when he died. Caesar's bloody toga was kept and shown to the mourners. Why not the same for Sinner? Yes, I suppose. Again I felt nauseated. I swayed on my feet. Are you unwell, Gordianus? It will pass, the sight of so much blood. On the day of the funeral, we shall burn it. This was said by Sappho as she stepped into the room. She wore a black gown with long sleeves and a cowl pulled back to form a plush collar. Her narrow face looked stark, white against the black. Since we have no body, this will have to do. On the funeral day, we shall burn it.
here in the atrium, and the smoke will travel through the opening in the ceiling. If we had nothing to burn, how else could the funeral end?
Except for her stutter, she sounded quite calm. Her face was expressionless, but there were dark circles under her eyes, and her cheeks were red and swollen.
"I tried to warn him," she went on, "but he insisted. It was the dream."
"A dream?"
"His dream of Caesar drove him from the house."
"Yes, he told me about it. Caesar insisted he come to a dinner party,
and Caesar showed him the abyss. My father then felt compelled to go to Caesar's funeral, to join Caesar in the abyss. That dream must have been sent to him by a god. Don't you think so, Fulvia?"
Fulvia stepped toward her and put a hand on the girl's shoulder, but Sappho shrugged it off.
"You were there, weren't you?"
Sappho stared at me without blinking.
"You saw, you heard. Is it true what they say? That the crowd took up that awful chant? 'I'm glad he's dead,' Cinna said. 'Now look what's left, just his head.'"
He flashed a crazed smile and giggled as people sometimes do in the most awful situations. "Who told you that?" I was shocked that anyone had recited such filth to her.
"What more can you tell me for Finder? You must tell me everything."
I shook my head. "I think you know too much already, Sappho." Suddenly, as if a mask had cracked and fallen away, I saw on her face a twisted expression, almost too horrible to look at. She began to twitch and thrash. I stepped toward her, thinking to restrain her, but Fulvia waved me back, then threw her arms around the girl, holding her tightly. "There, there, you poor grieving child," cried Fulvia. The old nursemaid appeared and joined Fulvia in restraining Sappho. "Where were you, Polyxo?" cried Fulvia, sounding angry. "Why did you let her leave her room?"
"I dozed off, only for a moment," said Polyxo. "I was up all night, tending to her, comforting her. I fell asleep. I couldn't help it."
Fulvia slapped the old slave woman across the face. The noise seemed to shock Sappho, who suddenly became rigid, then shivered and began to weep. "Now, Polyxo," snapped Fulvia, "take her to her room." With one arm around the girl, clutching her tightly, the old nursemaid led Sappho away. "You must excuse Sappho," said Fulvia, catching her breath. "She has a nervous disposition, even at the best of times. She's been that way ever since her mother died, when Sappho was still a child. After all that's happened, she's totally distraught. Her grief has induced a kind of delirium." "Perhaps reality is too awful to face," I said.
"Yes, that's it," agreed Fulvia. "And when reality is too terrible to bear, who knows what forces may be unleashed?"
Chapter 46. "I think perhaps those blows to my head did more damage than I realized," I said, gazing into the flickering flames of a brazier that needed stirring. I was standing in the garden, with only Diana nearby. The mild day had become a mild evening, with just enough of a nip in the air to merit a warming fire. Diana approached, and used an iron rod to stir the burning wood. The flames leaped higher. Glowing cinders flew and quickly faded.
"Are you serious, Papa?"
She put down the iron and touched my forehead, searching for fever, and tilting her head when she detected none. "Perhaps befuddlement has become my natural state. Your father is an old man, after all."
"What are you talking about, Papa? What's troubling you?"
I should have foreseen the death of Caesar. Oh, Papa, no one saw it coming. Not Mito, not Cicero, not Caesar himself.
Verrina did.
Because he issued a vague warning with a month for it to play out. Beware is hardly a prediction of murder.
Beware, I whispered, thinking of the Greek word written at Cinna's doorstep. A prediction of his murder? But how was that possible, since he was murdered by mistake?
You're a wise and clever man, Papa, but you're not a seer like Tiresias.
No, more like Oedipus.
If you wish. Oedipus was certainly clever and famous for it, like you. He solved the riddle of the Sphinx.
Yet he couldn't see the crime in front of his nose. He was blind to his own actions. What a horrid tale, that any man should kill the father he never knew and marry his own mother, and produce a family of fratricides.
Poems and plays are mostly horrid tales, Papa, or hadn't you noticed?
Yes, but the incest of Oedipus with his mother
is in a category by itself, I suppose.
Is it? Caesar wrote a tragedy in verse about Oedipus. Did you know that? Cinna's famous poem was all about incest, too. Why do people crave such stories?
Perhaps they crave what they can't have in reality.
Do they? I shook my head. Nothing seems to make sense any more. My head is filled with such horrors. Caesar stabbed to death in front of me, riots in the forum, Cinna's horrible end. Poems and plays about the most forbidden things imaginable, yet nothing connects with anything else. It's all loose ends.
But you know that isn't true, Papa.
You've always taught me otherwise. In the end, there are no loose ends. Everything connects. What if that's not true? What if there's no sense to anything?
Sleep on it, Papa, and pray not to have unpleasant dreams.
The brazier abruptly burned low, and then emitted a last puff of smoke. It was time for bed. I slept. I dreamed. I was in a dim, formless place. I heard my father speaking to me. It's best to die with your head on your shoulders, son, so the priests say, otherwise it goes badly for you in Hades. My father actually said such a thing to me when I was very small. I would later realize he was only half serious, teasing me. But the words made a lasting impression. For the rest of my life, whenever I saw a severed head, which was far too often, as when the dictator Sulla filled the forum with the heads of his enemies displayed on pikes, I remembered those words. In the dream, mists parted, and I found myself on a low spit of land with a muddy shore, beyond which a flat grey sea stretched to a featureless grey horizon. All was lit by a soft light too weak to cast shadows. "These are the shores of ugliness," said a voice in my ear. I turned, but there was no one there. A foul odour permeated the air. It was the smell of a slaughterhouse or a battlefield the day after. I choked at the stench of clotted blood and flesh beginning to rot. I mounted a low dune, and from the top saw a vast plain before me with no living thing, not a single tree or blade of grass. But there was movement everywhere, and by the feeble light I perceived to the left a multitude of headless bodies, wandering endlessly and aimlessly, blindly bumping into each other. I looked to the right, and saw what I took to be a field of cabbages. And I realized that the cabbages were in fact heads. They stared upward with wide open eyes, and their mouths moved constantly, shaping words with no breath to give them sound. I knew they were calling out to their bodies, but the heads had no way to speak, and the bodies
no way to see or hear. I heard a flapping of wings, hovering about the endless mass of bodies and heads. I saw the three Furies, Alecto, Magira, Tisiphone. They had snouts like dogs and bulging, bloodshot eyes that glowed like coals. Snakes writhed atop their heads. Their bodies were as black as coal, as were their leathery, bat-like wings. Their gnarled hands and feet were like the black talons of some giant bird. Each clutched in her right hand a scourge with brass-studded strips of leather. Occasionally, one of the sisters would swoop down and wield her scourge against the headless shoulders of a wandering body, making it grovel and writhe in pain. All three sisters would cackle with delight at the sight of such suffering. Then another would swoop down, snatch one of the heads with her feet, fly high in the air, wheeling like a vulture, then drop the head. All three would flap their wings and cackle as the head opened its mouth in a long, soundless scream and plunged to earth. "This is the place in Hades where the beheaded dwell for eternity," said the unseen voice. I shuddered, imagining such endless cruelty. "Is Cinna here?" "He is." "But why? What crime could be so horrible that he deserves such punishment?" "You know." "I don't." "You do. You know, and yet you don't know. You see the truth, yet you look away." "Where is he? Let me speak to him." Some unseen force pushed me forward into the grotesque cabbage patch of heads. I lurched and stumbled, trying not to step on them. Then I saw the head of Cinna staring up at me. "Why are you here?" I asked. "Why did the Furies come for you and bring you to this place?" His lips moved, but made no sound. It was just as when I had seen him last, when his head was held aloft in the forum. I remembered the fist that had clutched him by the hair, a gnarled, black, claw-like hand covered with blood. The hand of a Fury? Had they been in the crowd, moving among us, guiding the savagery, delighting in it, even taking part? I reeled at the enormity of it. Had the Furies themselves ripped Cinna to pieces, then carried off his body, flying away with their bat-like wings, clutching the various parts of Cinna with black talons? No wonder he had vanished without a trace. Something changed. Not the vague light or the shuffling sound of those aimlessly wandering bodies, but the smell. On the thick, still air, I caught a whiff of burning myrrh. But the scent did nothing to relieve the slaughterhouse stench. If anything, it made the heavy air even harder to breathe. I saw the misery deepen on Cinna's face. Tears streamed from his eyes. He wept, without making a sound. Day 13, March 22nd. Chapter 47. "But this can't be right," I said, squinting at the scrap of parchment by the early morning light, as if the words might change if I looked at them hard enough. The messenger had arrived at the crack of dawn. I was already up, having awakened from my nightmare. The message was unsigned, but the slave had been sent by Fulvia. I shook my head. "Cinna's funeral can't be today. There should be at least a few days of mourning. It's not decent." "But if there's no body to be shown to visitors, why wait to have the funeral?" said Diana, yawning and stretching her arms. She was still dressed in a sleeping gown of pleated linen. The fabric was rather thin, especially when stretched across her breast by her upraised arms. The resulting transparency no doubt pleased her husband, but made her father a bit uncomfortable. I stared at the message, which simply said that I should